KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Marijuana laws in Colorado and here in Washington. It's one big story making headlines. As I speak right now, Secretary of State John Kerry is making the case for military intervention in Syria. We're tracking that. Joining me to talk over the week's news, as it happens in this case, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger, and in the Viking chair, filling the mighty shoes of Knut Berger, is Peter Jackson, editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. And it's always nice to have you back with us.
You're very kind.
Well, good. Not kind. Always honest. Let's start with yesterday's news about marijuana. Attorney General Eric Holder, after months, I mean, it's been months that people have waited, he finally says he won't challenge our new pot law. But he did add a long list of stipulations that said, you know, he said, if any of these were violated, I'll challenge it later. First of all, it finally came, so everybody's happy. But the stipulations are no minors, no leakage of pot across the borders. I mean, it just sounds like we're talking about setting up the little Republic of Washington State with a fence.
Well, think about this from the administration's point of view. So you have President Obama, big day. He's got Eric Holder on line one, Syria on line two. I mean, this is not, in the scheme of things, a huge deal. So a couple states want to experiment. And, you know, they call up the two governors, Jay Inslee, who seemed that he was waiting for it, and then Governor Hickenlooper, whose name I love to say over and over again. And he just said, okay, I'm going to trust the states to experiment, but don't mess this up in many ways, as you were referring, Marcy, to the specific concerns. And in one case, they said, you know, they don't want the distribution as it shakes out to go across state borders. But politically, it might go across state borders, because isn't Oregon talking about becoming one of the next states to do so?
Well, I also wonder, like, what kind of border patrol are we talking about here? So, you know, are we checking IDs of pot buyers?
That's going to be the hardest thing, I think, in that list of eight items that the federal government is going to look at very closely. Controlling the borders is going to be an incredibly hard one. But if Oregon legalizes marijuana, that's one huge border that we don't have to worry about. And the border with Canada is not really the federal government's concern in terms of leakage into BC. So maybe that would make it easier. But that is going to be the biggest problem, I think, the state trying to control its borders in a way it's never really had to before and honestly can't, given the budget situation.
Peter, how did Snohomish County officials react to the news? We got a flurry of emails here from Mayor McGinn of Seattle, from Pete Holmes, the city's lead attorney, Jim Pugel, chief of police, all applauding this decision. Are people as welcoming of that up in Everett?
I want to say not so much. If you look, for example, with medical marijuana, cities like Everett, which the biggest city in Snohomish County, essentially wants to redline those kinds of facilities out of the city. So it's kind of wishing and hoping that it somehow would go away. I think it'll be fascinating after 502 takes effect to see if we'll have sort of the equivalent of dry counties in Washington State, because I think there are, in some ways, it might magnify some of the divide, the cultural divide too.
Well, there are
in the state.
There are jurisdictions that are talking about setting up some kind of regulations to not criminalize pot, because I think that would be against state law, but at least redline is probably the right word.
Or they wanted to delay the timing. I think there's Puyallup. Was that who it was? Was it Puyallup?
Both Puyallup and Everett decided to kind of kick the can. And I think that's going to be kind of the MO for a lot of communities that just don't – they're concerned in some ways, I think, probably too, that they're going to have to ramp up policing and other enforcement, especially with minors and transfer of pot.
And if I've understood right, there's the opposite concern in Seattle, that the State Liquor Control Board, which is still in the process of drawing up the rules, has said you can't be within X feet of this, you know, you can't be near a federal facility or on a federal facility, you can't be near a school, and it starts to really sweep out a lot of Seattle.
And so you have this funny dynamic where you have you know, state budget writers. They're not going to admit this, but they would love to hear what kind of a delightful number they could get from the revenue from taxing the pot, while the zoning issues are going to be just enormous here. Enormous, as different communities say, sure, you know, that's the law of the land, but we don't want it near schools, we don't want it near playgrounds, we don't want it near a whole variety of things.
Well, you mentioned revenue, Joni, and it's interesting because it's going to cost a lot of money to do some of the policing that the feds are putting into place, sort of superimposing on Washington State's law. You know, how are you going to know who and where people are from when they're finally finding the place that's dispensing this marijuana?
Well, isn't there an offset of some sort? Police don't have to spend their time writing tickets for this crime, so there's some time and money therefore saved. The question is, does that offset and go over to the other side of the ledger, the things that the Fed said you better take care of?
But you mean, can someone from Idaho drive to Spokane
sure.
and load up
mm-hmm.
his truck
sure.
with pot and drive?
Yeah, I mean, all I imagine is, you know, that fence that they're talking about building in the Southwest. Are we talking about fencing in Washington State
well,
so
right.
this leakage doesn't happen?
Well, that's the point. The federal government can't even control our borders with respect to drug smuggling, never mind, you know, immigration, which everyone always gets all bothered about. So it's bizarre that the federal government thinks that Washington State could do the same for its borders. But I think what's being drawn here is a loophole that the federal government can come through to shut this down if it wants to. I do think it's important, you know, as complex and intricate as this is, it is important to step back and look at what's happening more broadly. This is how the drug war gets dismantled. And it is going to be very complex and intricate, and it's going to be very hard. And it's very, very exciting that we are the laboratory, along with Colorado, for doing that. It won't be easy.
Has anyone interviewed Gil Kerlikowske? And, you know, he's going from drug policy czar to essentially the border chief under Homeland Security. It would be fascinating to get his read on this. Joni, do you?
I haven't interviewed him, but I have read things that he has said. And, you know, he held out pretty long with his argument that he's had for a very long time, which was that he thinks, you know, any kind of smoking is not good for your health. And so he held on to that even as he made this job change. Mm-hmm. But my question is, are they filling the drug czar job, or are they letting that go away? Because that's a statement similar to
right.
this statement.
Yeah.
These are pretty amazing statements from the federal government if you just compare to things that had been said earlier.
I just have to throw in one little other thing that the feds did yesterday. The Treasury Department and the IRS sort of just threw out there that it's okay for same-sex legally wed couples to file joint tax returns. And I heard at least one comment thinking, well, the marriage industry in Washington is just going to pick right up, because this is an acknowledgement that if you're married in a state where it's legal to be wed, like Washington State, then that marriage is going to be recognized.
Well, in fact, if you live in a state where it's not recognized, you can still file a joint tax return if you were married in a state where
right.
it is legal. So if you get married here and move to Idaho.
So isn't that a federal recognition of marriage across the land?
Yes, and it's huge. Now, they're not doing the same thing for Social Security. That has a different, and I haven't read exactly what it is, but there's something different going on with Social Security. So again, we see these huge cultural changes and changes in legal status of things that used to be illegal, and an incredible number of details that have to be worked out on the other side of that decision. But this is, again, huge progress.
But for what Marcy's point here, the idea that on the same day these federal rulemakings would come out, now they probably didn't coordinate it, it's probably just like that, but to have those two kinds of decisions come out where the government, you can see it move, it's moving, it's changing its policies, was just darn interesting.
I don't know about your radar, Peter. Your job is to probably pay attention to everything. But these things, that one just kind of zipped right out there. Here's the IRS. Oh, by the way, you can file joint tax returns. Meanwhile, you know, the whole locus of federal government is worrying about Syria and bombing and gay couples can be married and we recognize them in the tax department.
It's pretty wonderful when you think. I mean, it telegraphs the level of acceptance for same-sex marriage when, you know, even a decade ago, the notion that this kind of acceptance would happen would have just been inconceivable.
And a lot of people have been saying for a long time who are far ahead of the federal government on this, can we just get past this and spend our energy on more important things? And here's a great example. It gives the federal government more bandwidth to deal with things like Syria, say, when it doesn't have to be spending so much time worrying about how to discriminate against gay couples and arrest, you know, people who are not smoking very much pot.
And, you know, President Obama many months ago, maybe 6-7 months ago, signaled that he might get to this, the position that he has now on pot, because he said, you know, look, these states have legalized it, Washington and Colorado. And then he says, you know, I have bigger fish to fry than to run after sort of marijuana users. So he did signal that. Mm-hmm. We should not be that surprised.
There was a movie that came out many, many years ago, remade, Miracle on 34th Street, which is about whether Santa Claus is legal and how or is real. And how the attorney proved it was that people wrote letters to Santa Claus, which the U.S. Postal Service delivered to the courtroom where the trial was going on. Thereby, a federal organization was recognizing something as legal. And I sort of feel like that about the IRS recognition, because it's a huge thing. It has a lot of financial implications for same-sex couples, but it's also a broader tacit acknowledgement that this is the law of the land. It's interesting. We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Peter Jackson. I'm Marcy Silman. We're going to take a break. Syria coming up in just a couple of minutes here on KUOW.
Since the mid-1930s, Tanglewood in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts has stood for the finest in classical music and popular entertainment. Well, it was a good run while it lasted. I'm Peter Sagal. Join me, Carl Castle, our panelists, and classical pianist Emmanuel Axe as we all twerk the news from Tanglewood on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the dairy farmers of Washington. Jim and Andy Werkoven are Washington dairy farmers who are working to help save salmon spawning ground. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
69 degrees in Seattle under a partly sunny sky. Forecast says it's going to stay partly sunny today. We expect to reach a high of 75. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 82. It's 10:19.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman with Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, associate editor for The Stranger, Eli Sanders, and Peter Jackson, editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. I'm sure you all heard that last night the British Parliament voted very closely not to join the U.S. in a military attack on Syria. And we know that earlier this morning, Secretary of State John Kerry was addressing the subject. The U.S. is still wanting to beef up its justification for going on that attack route, not solo, because France has said it will join in for good or bad. But here is Secretary of State Kerry speaking earlier this morning.
Our intelligence community has carefully reviewed and re-reviewed information regarding this attack. And I will tell you, it has done so more than mindful of the Iraq experience. We will not repeat that moment.
Well, in fact, what he's talking about is getting us into a war, an unofficial war, because I actually was checking facts. The Congress has not declared war since 1941. So all these these things that we've been embroiled in are not officially wars. But this is a big thing. The British Parliament, BBC, was kind of running the debate, and it was very heated, because there's this very fuzzy line between we think that Syria needs to be slapped on the wrist at the very least for what it's been doing to its own people. On the other hand, a huge fear of another dozen years embroiled in a conflict we can't get out of.
Well, Iraq is really on everyone's mind here, as you can tell. You have Representative Adam Smith, very high on the Armed Services Committee in the House. He's talking about this very carefully, how to urge caution, and he's mindful of the fact that he did vote for action in Iraq. You have Patty Murray, who did not vote for action in Iraq, saying roughly the same thing. More than 100 members of Congress saying we'd like to be consulted. You have the British Parliament saying no. You have a lot of people saying we don't want to do what happened last time. We got stuck in something. We had bad information, as it turned out, and, you know, ever mindful. And so that the fact that John Kerry, that would be the main thing, is this is no Iraq, shows he's worried about the exact same thing.
Well, and what I hear him saying is the intelligence is different this time. Mm-hmm. He's trying to say that, but the burden is so high, I'm not sure you can overcome it. The problem with Iraq, and what I hear him addressing there, is the fact that we were steamrolled and misled into a war based on phony or faulty intelligence. And so when you stand up and say 10 years later or more than 10 years later, the intelligence community has said this is going on, a lot of people are very reluctant to trust that, and with good reason. And so the burden is so high, I'm not sure how you overcome that short of something very convincing coming from the UN inspectors. So then you would have a different party in addition to the U.S. intelligence community. But they are only, as I understand it, going to determine whether or not chemical weapons were used and not who used them. And so there will continue to be a muddle because, you know, Russia has been saying that, well, the rebels have been using chemical weapons. And I just don't see the kind of clarity that is going to swing public opinion here coming anytime soon. That may not matter because President Obama has said he may do it on his own, no matter what people say.
I know it could happen any time. And what, at least I read, what's going to happen, it's not a regime change kind of action. It really is. He called it a shot across Syria's bow. Yeah, what's the point?
Which is kind of tragic when you think about it, that we'll be taking action that's largely symbolic.
Right.
And I mean, you have Americans who have this just enormous war fatigue. And yet you have something that should be morally unambiguous, the use of chemical weapons. You know, if you had some Catholic just war theorist here, they would say, well, you know, civilians were targeted. You were using a weapon of mass destruction. It should be crystal clear. But there's just that cynicism. I mean, it's, again, going back to Iraq, it's when they would say, you know, this isn't the Gulf of Tonkin. You know, we have real evidence here that this is weapons exist. So the
one of the issues that's emerged in the last couple of days is when Obama said if you use chemical weapons on your people, you would be crossing a red line. And so now there's this huge brouhaha about whether should he have said that, because now that they've crossed that red line, you're supposed to say, oh, there's only one response, perhaps.
Well, it's a credibility question now, and that's...
Yeah, which is what Eli was just talking about. Somebody sort of to pile on here, there was somebody wrote, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who wrote it, but one of our producers said, well, you know, what's the role of journalists? The last time around, a lot of journalists just said, yay, go to war. So what is our ilk doing right now, and what is our role?
From what I've picked up, there's a lot more skepticism and a lot of awareness and references to the Iraq experience. And even the New York Times, which got in a lot of trouble for, you know, people would say cheerleading for the Iraq war, has been much more cautious. They've done great reporting trying to nail down what in fact happened, really incredible reporting that you don't see in any other newspaper, at least as far as I've seen. But their editorial page has said there needs to be more proof before anything happens.
This is also just back to what Peter was saying. What, you know, you could maybe justify this war, military intervention. But what is our role globally? Are we the moral arbiters, the United States? And, you know, if the Syrian people really want a different regime, or any other people want a different regime, I mean, what role should the U.S. play in that regime change? Is it our job to step in everywhere?
It's a very difficult question with a very inconsistent answer. If you went back to the Rwandan genocide, you would see a very different response from a lot of people in this country to the United States' responsibility to intervene in a civil war where lots of people were being killed. And so it varies. It just really varies. And it's hard to know. Well, I don't know. I don't have an ironclad rule for what you do, and no one else does either.
That's the heart of the debate if you don't have a coalition. If it's the U.S., and France, if it's that, then it's really the U.S. Come on,
right?
We're the one moving all the equipment in the area, the military equipment. So then, that is the question. That's what everyone's debating. Every time And, you know, no one is going to sit and say anything defensive about using chemical weapons on your own people. But then who is the judge, and who is the, you know, who then carries out the ruling of that? Is it always going to be the U.S.? That's the debate.
Well, and the question, too, is, I mean, this would be strictly punitive, or would we actually be able to preempt the use of chemical weapons? And we don't know where the chemical – I mean, it's
– You don't blow up the chemical weapons, because then that spreads more. So you're really just the shot across the bow, right, to kind of make your point.
And to defend international norms is what some people are saying. And the idea that there are rules of war that the international community has for the most part agreed to, although Syria is not a party to the chemical weapons ban, but that there are overarching international norms that need to be enforced for the benefit of everyone in the world community. But the problem is exactly as you said. People can largely agree to that, and then when it comes time to enforce it, they can say, well, you do it.
Yeah. It's a fascinating question, and we're speaking now. John Kerry has just finished his big speech in the war room, giving what sounds like a U.S. justification for taking some military action from Tomahawk missiles. They've got five warships sitting there waiting to launch these missiles at some place in Syria for some unknown amount of time. They say no boots on the ground, but, you know, it's a big but, and it's a big question, and we don't even know when this is going to happen.
And you can't predict the next dominoes that fall.
Right.
And so there's a way in which you can say no boots on the ground, we're not going to intervene, but once we have intervened, even just with cruise missiles, there will be a heightened scrutiny of what happens next and a kind of responsibility laid on the United States for what happens next. And you can imagine all kinds of scenarios where if this was our response to this happening and something worse happens, we're going to be expected to have a response to that too. And so you just get pulled in and in and in.
Right now, a lot of the congressional representatives, Adam Smith and Patty Murray among them, are upset because really there hasn't been a lot of consultation with Congress about this. Should that happen before we take any steps militarily?
Well, we had Rick Larson into our editorial board this week, and he's on the Armed Services Committee. And it's essentially kind of they brief you just before they're about to attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so it not only kind of defangs the role of Congress, but it also waters down the War Powers Act and this notion that there has to be some kind of consultation. And so it automatically instills a sense of resentment and powerlessness.
There was some conference call scheduled with key members last night, and then I heard some folks talking about the fact that it's not on a secure line. So this, you know, as everyone knows, Congress is on vacation, and so they would have to be called back to avoid the whole non-secure line thing. So what to do? So should Obama call the folks back and really run this through, like some of them are suggesting? Is a conference call suitable, especially one on a non-secure line? Because one of the effects of that is you don't say so much on that because the line is not secure.
It would be interesting to see the debate if it happened, because a lot of Republicans have been criticizing Obama for not being forceful enough.
But now they're turning around and criticizing him for not involving them in the decision.
Right. And they also see where the public polling is. And so they're trying to figure out some way to get on the right side of that. Plus, they are perpetually committed to making him look bad.
Right. So whatever he would do, we want that.
Try to have enough of them wanting the opposite that it would be very difficult for him. You know, we did a poll on the Strangers blog on Monday, seeing what people thought about military intervention in Syria. I put up a post. It was something like 70% of people opposed on Monday. I did another one this morning just to see how it had moved since Britain, you know, deciding it wouldn't participate and all the other events of this week. And it's only become stronger. Something like 85% of people who read our blog now are opposed to military intervention. So this is another thing that's not on the president's side if he wants to act. The longer this goes on, it seems like the more people have questions and opposition to this.
Margie emails, whether the government used chemical weapons is the wrong question. The question is, why would anyone think military action would accomplish anything? We need intense diplomatic action. A military strike would be a support to al-Qaeda against Hezbollah. I don't know enough about the ins and outs to know if that's true, but diplomatic action, the U.S. had agreed with Russia that there was going to be a summit about Syria, and because the relationship between the U.S. And Russia is so bad right now, that just keeps being pushed further and further back. They can't agree to talk.
Well, my understanding was it got pushed back because Russia has just an irreconcilably different opinion of what's going on. And so there was no point, that was Kerry's argument, in sitting down with them. The Russians aren't convinced that this happened. And if it did, they think someone else might have done it.
But it is also true that relations between the two countries are at a pretty low point at this point. He's important. Peter Jackson, is that from the White House?
That is.
A text from the White House?
It looks like things are going to be happening soon.
All right. Well, good.
I can't tell you anymore.
We're talking over the week's news with Peter Jackson, buzzing away, editorial page editor of the Everett Herald, Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times. And when we know more about Syria, listeners, you will know more about Syria. But you talked about, Eli, the Republicans' aim to always make President Obama look bad. Susan Hutchison was elected Washington State.
Awesome segue. I gotta give points on that one.
And one of her key lines in her speech was, you know, we are right, they are wrong. It's a fascinating thing. Is it all so black and white?
Well, you know, I looked that phrase up because I had heard it before, so I Googled it, and a zillion people have said it. But you know who else said it? Just many years ago, was Mike Lowry used to say that about tax increases and things like that.
Yeah. Really?
That phrase, that's an adamant phrase, obviously.
Yes, it is.
And it's a we'll convince you that we know what we're doing and you should come with us kind of a phrase. I was surprised to see her use that just because I had remembered that Lowry had talked like that. And so have many other people. If you Google it, you'll see what I'm talking about. But we do have a new Republican State Party chair. She's a very well-spoken, knows how to work the media, is of the media.
Right.
And, you know, listen, when you have a party chair, that's part of what they do is represent the party by explaining things that they do, defending things that they do. And so I think she's going to be, an interesting leader for the party.
It certainly has nowhere to go but up. I mean, when you read about this, the description was, you know, the party is close to bankrupt. It's lost, you know, almost every office in the statewide elections except the Secretary of State's office. It can't find a candidate who can appeal to moderates in the suburban crescent around Seattle and to hardcore conservatives in the eastern part of the state. So, you know, good luck. But the state seems to be speaking and speaking and speaking on this question, and Republicans here and across the country are out of step with what Washington State wants. I mean, just the two issues that we were talking about at the top of the show, gay marriage and marijuana, the state, again, has spoken, and that's not where Republicans here are.
Is Susan Hutchison a social moderate?
That remains to be seen, as politicians like to say. Yeah, no, I mean, she may have broad appeal. It's kind of hard to tell. What's interesting is she has pinpointed what she thinks, and other Republicans have said the problem is, which is not only raising money, but grassroots and getting those folks out. But, time will tell because, yes, the Democrats were much better at that mobilization of grassroots activists and people in coordination with the Obama campaign. But are those people even out there? And especially on the West side, she is right. It's become like a one-party state, and that's not healthy.
Well, one thing she addressed, though, and this was very clear in that last governor's race, was that very scientific, and I don't have the right word for it, but that very scientific targeting of voters who had not yet turned in their ballots. Mm. The Democrats had some kind of a computer program or something that helped them figure out where the ballots were. I mean, you can call up the various election offices and find out who hasn't voted. But then they mobilized and went and got those people everything about the ballot. Is your signature okay? Did your ballot leave your house? Where's the voter? They did a lot of that. And she spoke, when she was speaking of this, she talked about that we're going to do that too.
It's worth pointing out that Susan Hutchison, who has been elected to save Republicans in King County, lost the race for King County Executive. So that, I think, points to the magnitude of the problem facing her. Even she, several years ago, could not figure out how to solve this puzzle.
But she also presented herself in that election as I'm not of a party. Now, all of a sudden, she is a Republican.
Which is another great irony here. They've elected as their leader someone who ran from the party when trying to win an election.
Right. Well, I'm curious, since Peter's here, and usually we're so King County-centric, is Snohomish now a purple county or a blue county?
I think it's relatively blue, although it's still that same formula of a third independence, third Democrat, and a third Republican. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's now, if you look at elected officials, we have 4 out of 5 of our county council members are Democrats. You have a Democratic county executive. But you have two of the more enterprising mayors, mayor of Marysville and mayor of Edmonds, are Republicans. So I don't think they're as diehard partisans as perhaps in King County. But you'll find, as most pundits know, that Snohomish and Pierce counties are really ones to watch, especially in statewide elections. They can swing it.
Well, Snohomish County is the bellwether county for the governor's race for many years. So whatever the number, the margin is, I think it's 0.07. Whatever Snohomish County does for this or that candidate, then the state does within 0.07% of that.
We've been talking over the past few weeks about the changing nature of Bellevue as a much more sort of cross-sectioned city with a lot not so Republican, not so rich, not so white anymore. And I wonder, as housing prices in King County get so expensive and we see people looking to buy and moving across the county borders, is Snohomish becoming a much more multicultural, a county that is more like King County, in other words?
Well, a good gauge of this actually would be a city like Linwood, where you really mm-hmm. see the changing demographics. You also see a politically disengaged population, sadly. So you still have a predominantly white city council and kind of a uniculture politically. But you see a lot of Ukrainians. You see all of the kind of demographic groups that you would think would populate South County with the changes that are going on. So, I mean, it's very healthy. The problem is that, I would say political empowerment. I hate the word empowerment, but
They're not turning out to vote.
They're not turning out to vote.
Is that because they're recent arrivals and they haven't connected yet to the schools and the community? Is that part of it?
To a certain extent, and to a certain extent, the need to organize. And that just takes, you know, sometimes it takes a generation. But I think it's promising. I think, and hopefully, a place like Snohomish County will be a bellwether, not only politically, but culturally and otherwise. We'll see.
We're talking over the week's news, and then I'm asking Peter, grilling Peter, since we have him here. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor of the Everett Herald, Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times. Talking over the week in review with me, Marcy Silman, here on KUOW.
Swing through Saturday night with music of the 1920s through the 1950s and beyond on The Swing Years. I'm Amanda Wild. Join me for adventures in popular music of the 20th century, The Swing Years, 7 p.m. to midnight, Saturday nights on 94.9 KUOW.
Gifts of stock and other appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For information about how to make a gift of securities, contact Matt Albertson at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
70 degrees and partly sunny in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to get up into the mid-70s today. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. According to the most recent census, more and more Americans are living alone instead of with families. Why is that, and what does it mean for society? We'll take that up in the 11 o'clock hour this morning.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, and you're listening to The Week in Review. Our panel of journalists is here: Peter Jackson of the Everett Herald, Eli Sanders from The Stranger, Seattle Times editor Joni Balter. And we're joined now by my colleague, Katie Sewell.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to see you again on this Friday.
Thank you. I'm just popping in to put everyone's fears to rest about what will happen to this panel starting next week, because, as you know, we're doing a lot of changes next week with the turn of fall. This panel is going to be staying, however. You will continue finding them at 10 a.m. on Fridays. Even though weekdays going away, even though the conversation is going away, the news and review panel will be Fridays at 10 a.m.
Live.
Live. Always every week, live. Hosted by you until Steve returns from sabbatical. And people, of course, will find you on The Record starting next week, which is from noon to 2 every day.
Starts on Tuesday.
Yes, Tuesday. I know, it's right around the corner. Labor Day will happen, and all of a sudden, it will be new programming all over KDOW.
You know, it's just like new school shoes that my mother used to get me the last week of August every year. So you can think of The Record as your new pair of shiny shoes that you're going
right.
to wear in.
They're shiny, a little tight some days, but then they get more comfortable.
Yeah, we aim to cover things. So that all starts, and KDOW is leaving in September as well. She's going to Italy with her husband for a great adventure.
Yes, I am. And I do want people to keep in touch with me if they're interested to. Email me at radiokaty@gmail.com.
KATY.
Yes.
No IEs.
No IEs.
This woman, you'll be hearing her. She'll be doing radio from Italy.
Yes.
In English.
In English. Yes.
Yeah, I don't because know I've checked out her Italian. It's not there yet.
No.
It's not there yet.
I've got you know, maybe 4 of the colors down. That's about it. So I really need to get to work
all right.
on that.
Arrivederci, KDOW.
Thank you, Marcy.
And now back to news. Yesterday, there were dozens of, probably hundreds, of fast food workers in the Seattle area who joined with their fellow fast food and low-wage workers in more than 50 cities around the country, a day-long strike. And one of the goals was to increase the public's understanding of their lack of livable wagehood. That was a horrible sentence. I'm sorry, listeners. I butchered it. But one of the questions I had was what value one of these kinds of days has.
Well, it's what you said. It has to do with awareness. I don't think it'll end up as big as Occupy Wall Street, but it sort of has that sort of summer incubation period and sloughs off perhaps into fall sense of people are talking about an issue, trying to give it some heft and some profile. And that is what's been happening. And it's not just people marching and talking. There actually was a petition to raise the minimum wage in SeaTac. 2,500 voters signed that, although the number is now in flux because a judge said that there weren't sufficient signatures. There maybe are not. But people are actually talking about responding to these concerns, with real laws and changes. Washington, as you know, has a $9.19 an hour minimum wage, which is the highest in the country. But the protests are here as well.
And they're making the point that even $9 an hour is not enough to live on. And when you multiply that out, you can see why even $15 an hour is something like $30,000 a year. A number of people have made the point this week in tandem with the anniversary of Martin Luther King's speech and the March on Washington that one of the overlooked calls that Dr. King made during his speech was for an increased minimum wage. And this was 1963, and he was calling for the federal minimum wage to be increased to $2 an hour. Hmm. Now, if you adjust that for inflation, that is actually right about $15 an hour. So that goal of Dr. King's in the speech that he made has not yet been reached, but it also puts in context what people are calling for today. It's not unreasonable. It's not something that no one has ever asked for before. In fact, it was asked for 50 years ago.
As you did the math just there, $15 an hour is barely a livable wage. So we're talking about the difference between a minimum wage and something you can actually support your family on.
The whole issue, I mean, I think resonates to the living wage movement. It's interesting to see what happens, especially in terms of farm workers in Snohomish mm-hmm. County and Skagit County, places where people don't really have the resources to.
That's too loud. I think it might be the other headphones reverberating there. We'll see. Oh, it is those other headphones. We have to turn those down. So Jason's coming here to do that. One of the questions I had, Bruce Ramsey in your newspaper yeah. had a column that actually didn't really – it raised questions. It didn't really answer them. And it was about – it's that whole notion of the impact of regulation on the job creators and whether it's farm owners who are hiring farm workers or McDonald's entrepreneurs –
Well, it seemed to me that column that he was planning it because the measure was going to be on the ballot in SeaTac, and then the judge ruled, and so then he raised it as a sort of a just a rhetorical question. And the rhetorical question was, what kind of economy? How would the businesses change, for example, at SeaTac Airport, if the $15 minimum was in there? And he interviewed quite a few people. And, for example, the Ivar's guy was saying, you know, that they pay $13 and some change plus all these benefits, but that they would one impact would be that they wouldn't be able to hire enough first-time employees, that would change that dynamic, that they'd hire, in their case, more accomplished chefs and cooks because that would be a wage that you would pay, but that the first-time employees would probably have a harder time getting a job at SeaTac. That was just one example of how the economy there would change if the minimum wage would be raised to $15 and on the ballot in SeaTac.
He also pointed out that economists completely disagree and have never reached any sort of consensus on whether raising the minimum wage encourages job creation, and he actually cited an instance where the minimum wage was raised in one state and not in another very nearby, and jobs were added in the state with the higher minimum wage.
Well, it brings up that whole question about job creators, because one of the sort of drumbeats that's gone on throughout the recession, which is officially over, is that, you know, you can't overregulate the job creators because they're not going to create any jobs. So now the economy is coming up, but there are not a lot of living wage jobs coming online. And my guess is, as Boeing tries to figure out what it's doing with its workforce, that those living wage jobs in your county, Peter, are people who hold those jobs, if they live in Snohomish County, are wondering, do I even get to stay where I live?
Right. And I think that kind of insecurity really creates a lot of angst. And I think it's something that definitely resonates in the county itself. But
another question that our newsroom had was whether yesterday's show of force was a victory for the labor movement, the fact that they could get so many people out in the streets demonstrating. Labor has not exactly, I mean, here in King County, it does play a role, especially in the mayor's race. We could talk about that endlessly. But the labor movement across the country, it has not been at its highest point recently.
Right. And so sometimes when you have there's also it's not specifically labor. It has more to do with immigration. But in May, there's another show of force.
Right.
And so these moments, you know, the labor movement is trying to figure out where it fits in this new economy. It's unclear. It's unclear how strong it'll be. It's unclear if you want to talk about Boeing,
right,
what Boeing's relationship is with its unions. And so days like that, you know, often in the summer, not so much maybe November, you know, are a moment for labor to say, here's what's on our minds.
No thoughts. Okay. Well, let's segue to a different labor force, which is teachers. And I don't know how teachers and their contracts are doing in Snohomish County, but right now there's a big pool, biggest district in the state. Teachers don't have a contract in Seattle. They vote again on Tuesday. At stake is more than money. It's all about how they are measured as teachers, their worth as teachers. It's about standardized tests. In Kitsap County, it's about classroom size.
Well, it started here. It started in Seattle as about classroom size. And then the district took a proposal to increase class sizes in, I think it was grades 4 to 12, was it?
Yeah.
They took that off the table. It was too hot. So then they thought they were going to be very close. The district thought they were going to be very close to a contract. Except the teachers then began to talk about evaluations, that the testing of students that contributes to evaluations, and they wanted a moratorium on that. They wanted not to have that be so present. So now that's where we're high-centered at the moment. There's been, I'm sure they're talking, but there's been no announcement that settles that. And so this seems to happen how many years? August? What do we do at the end of August? We talk about teacher strikes.
But this vote is scheduled for the day before classes are supposed to start.
Which is also common to give the teachers maximum leverage and to get people when they are hopefully most appreciative of teachers. Parents are ready to have their kids back out of the house, and kids are excited about going back to school.
Or not.
A teacher that I know posted on Facebook today or yesterday saying that if you calculate his hourly rate, it's less than your average babysitter would make. And this connects to the thought that I was trying to find a moment ago and lost, but that the minimum wage the minimum wage effort and the fast food strike effort that's trying to call attention to the need for an increased minimum wage is not just about fast food workers. If it's successful, it will raise the living standards and the wage standards for everyone. And so people well beyond fast food industry will benefit from this. For example, teachers who will be able to say, come on, I'm earning less than someone who works at McDonald's. Bring me up to at least parity.
Teachers don't make a lot of money right now. The other thing that's just starting to come online are charter schools, which I know wasn't in your set of links that you were supposed to read.
Oh, my gosh. No. It wasn't in the packet.
What are these charters?
Yes. But it was interesting. We have been taping interviews for this new show, The Record, and one was with a charter school organizer from Spokane because they're allowed to be filing their applications. And one of the questions asked of her was whether the charter school teachers would make the same amount as the teachers.
What was the answer?
Unions. With some pushing, she said yes. But
make the same.
They would make the same because I believe that charter schools are public schools, so they're not to be treated differently. But it's a really good question. I'm assuming in Snohomish County you're going to see charter school applicants.
Most likely. And in fact, actually, Everett School District teachers, I think, are paid maybe the best in the state. In part because they organized early. And we actually had one of the first teacher strikes in 1977. So we were kind of in the vanguard of
how big is the school district? How many kids in Everett? Do you know?
I don't know. I could make something up. No. A million kids. There are a million kids in Everett.
Everett.
Or it just feels like a million kids. How
it's
about
the new metropolis. Well, you know, while we talk about money, it was revealed this week that there were more budget overruns on the 520 bridge. And Republicans have gone on the record as saying that they'd support some sort of revenue enhancement, I believe is their term, for statewide transportation projects, if and only if our four demands are met. But this isn't going to happen until the legislative session. I'm sure that there's projects.
Now, they may call a special session, is my understanding. And
really?
They're going to be coming up to Snohomish County and a few other places, and they're doing the rounds, the ed board rounds. It's conditional on these reforms.
Right.
Yes, but the cost overruns on 520 don't help build, shall we say, support for the tax package that actually never got through. And so if you recall, at the end of the legislative session, there was some momentum, a little bit of momentum, and then it stalled to get a tax package. And it would have had some money, as I understand it, for 520. But now you need more money for 520, and so people will be quite not happy about that.
How much was the overrun?
$128 million, and then another $100 million, I think, something like that. But anyway, it's $128 million, but it puts it over its reserve.
There was another anniversary this week, in addition to the March on Washington, the 520 bridge that we are tearing apart to build this new one that is so expensive, turned 50 this week. Less important anniversary.
And what did you get the bridge?
You drove across it.
Yeah, I gave it my toll money.
Yeah,
it might help, but it doesn't seem that it will.
Yeah, well, toll.
It was also a reminder, 50 years is actually kind of young for a project that costs so much money back then and will cost so much to replace. And it's just, I guess, a reminder of what huge investments these are and the hope that we could build pontoons that would, you know, crack maybe 100 years down the line rather than right off the assembly line.
Yeah, right, so as we install them. Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the issues with replacing the Skagit County Bridge, was that the way that it works was that you get to replace the amount of money that comes would be the cost of building the bridge initially, as opposed to what it would cost to actually revamp it. So you get the fix money as opposed to the hundreds of millions that it would take to really put a new bridge. But that new bridge is supposed to be online soon.
I want to say within the next 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a big project. And it's interesting because we all used it as sort of the metaphor for our broken transportation system. And this is why we need a package.
But
and
it was repaired quickly, right?
It was repaired quickly. Yeah. I mean, at least on a, if you want to call it repaired.
Temporary.
Have you driven across this new?
I have not. I will be driving across it this weekend. Okay. So I have an opportunity to sit out.
I hope you write about it. I'm kind of curious because the idea that it's just like this little... I picture sort of the automotive equivalent of one of those suspension bridges that you walk across that moves back and forth. Just quickly, you refer to this, Eli, 50 years, March on Washington. There were amazing celebrations and people's memories of this. I remember it vaguely. I'm old enough to have been alive, but not the way that some of the memories were given out, and especially on the day itself. The speeches were just amazing. I don't know if you heard any of them.
You know, I unfortunately didn't get a chance to watch them. My attention was struck by the mention of his call for the minimum wage and the connection to the minimum wage protests this week, but I didn't get to see the speeches this week, which I regret. I'd like to go back and watch them. And I was born something like 15 years after the March on Washington, so I don't have the same perspective that a lot of people participating did.
Am I the oldest one in this room? Probably.
Well, the New York Times, just to go to somebody who did remember it, the New York Times had some very good sort of first-person accounts of folks who, you know, were reluctant to go and then ended up going to the March on Washington. And there was this one guy who, you know, he was afraid when the police to ask the police for help, but the police in D.C. not only told him how to get to the march, but also sort of helped figure out housing. It was really a touching story that, you know, that this person barely was willing to go, but made the trip, and it turned out quite well for him.
Drew Hansen, state legislator, wrote a great book on the "I Have a Dream" speech, and he's been tweeting all week, and it's been pretty wonderful.
It has. I should let you all know that President Obama is due to talk about Syria in just a few minutes, according to CNN, and we'll bring you that when we have that information. And one can only speculate about what he will be saying to us as a nation. With that, dear panel of journalists, I release you to Labor Day weekend. Peter Jackson, editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. So great to have you here.
You're very kind.
Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Always good to see you, as it is to see you. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for The Seattle Times.
And you as well.
The Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. You all have a great Labor Day weekend.
It's 10:59, a news update from NPR just ahead. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms & More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, a local resource for natural and organic mattresses with an extensive selection of natural bedding, pillows, and toppers. Online at bedroomsandmore.com.
You know the typical news from Western media in China, corruption, computer hacking, but what about satirical headlines like CSI Shanghai canceled due to lack of crime?
Of course, being in China, quite a lot of those headlines either end up becoming true or very close to the truth.
A window into satire and irony in China today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 2 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Blue Homes, building modern-designed, precision-built homes. An open house tour of a glide house on Vashon Island will be held September 7th and 8th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Directions and more information available at bluhomes.com/Vashon.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.